Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pace. Statistics tell us that 3 people a day are hit by cars while walking in San Francisco. In the course of a year, 100 pedestrians are seriously injured or killed due to vehicle collisions. San Francisco ranks worst out of all California counties for pedestrian injuries related to these types of traffic accidents. Those of us who live here would be hard-pressed to miss visible efforts across the city to re-engineer streets to be more conducive to pedestrian and cyclist safety. That's because in 2014, the city made a concerted effort to improve the safety of our streets by adopting Vision Zero, an international initiative with the goal of eliminating traffic deaths completely. San Francisco has pledged to reach that goal by 2024. 3 years into the initiative, San Francisco has seen only a modest decrease in fatalities, and local experts feel that gains are inadequate. Death and injury statistics have not budged much here, and in other cities, such as New York, they've seen already marked reductions in injuries and fatalities. And statistics like these, though, only tell part of the story. As we discuss the successes of Vision Zero and the challenges of creating and maintaining safer streets here, we will also hear about the very personal impact of pedestrian fatality and vehicular injury. So now, some 3 years into Vision Zero, we'll ask what gains have those efforts made here in San Francisco and what work is yet to be done. And joining me here in the studio to discuss these questions and more are Kathy DeLuca. She's interim director of Walk SF, San Francisco's only pedestrian advocacy organization since 1998. Welcome, Kathy.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Also joined by Julie Mitchell. She's co-founder of San Francisco Bay Area Families for Safe Streets, a volunteer group of individuals who have personally survived a severe traffic crash or whose loved ones have been killed or seriously injured in a traffic crash. Welcome, Julie.
Thank you.
And we're also joined here in the studio by Roger Rudick. He is editor of Streets Blog San Francisco. Streets Blog is a daily news source that covers the movement to transform our cities by reducing dependence on private automobiles and improving conditions for pedestrians, cyclists, and transit riders. Welcome, Roger.
Thank you, Joseph.
And in a little while, Dr. Rochelle Dicker will be joining us. She is a trauma surgeon and former director of the Injury Prevention Center at UCSF. And we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. We'd like to hear your stories, your experiences as pedestrians, cyclists, and motorists. Call us in about 20 minutes as we open our phone lines at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us now at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KALW website, or tweet us at City Visions KALW. So, Kathy DeLuca with Walk SF, I wanted to start with you. Why don't you paint a picture of how Vision Zero came to be and how it's been going these last 3 years?
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. So, back in the early 2010s, a lot of advocates here in the United States were really getting excited about this idea called Vision Zero. And this originated in Sweden. And the idea was that basically no loss of life is acceptable on our streets, that human error is to be expected, and that our transportation system should accommodate that, and that no mistake, which is going to happen, should result in someone dying. So advocates here in San Francisco and in other cities, advocates from Walk SF, advocates from the Bicycle Coalition and other community groups came together and really pushed the city to adopt Vision Zero. And the city had been working on pedestrian safety and bike safety and traffic safety for years. But with this framework that no loss of life is acceptable, we know we can look at data and use that data to see where people are getting hit, why they're getting hit, and then address those issues. There was sort of a resurgence and a feeling like we can do this. And so in 2014, with a lot of different city agencies involved, the Department of Public Health did a great job collecting data on crashes and on injuries and a lot of police data. It was really this just multi-agency effort and then community-driven effort. And so in 2014, the city adopted this wonderful vision of no deaths on our streets from traffic because we know that they're preventable. So it's a wonderful step for the city to take. We've got 7 years to go, so we still have time, and we're all still working really hard on it.
So before I ask you to tell me what's been done and what's the impact been, I wanted to ask you, how has this effort been different from previous efforts or efforts that you said were already kind of ongoing?
Yeah. Well, the city was already moving in this direction, but it's really about looking at data. That's really the crux of Vision Zero, is to look at the data and to use that to fix our streets. And so, because data is really power. So the Department of Public Health did collect all of this data, and they found that crashes were clustering on certain streets in the city. They weren't happening randomly. So they actually mapped all of the collisions and that found that 12% of all crashes happened on only 7% of city streets. And so that's actually really good news, in that we actually know what streets we need to fix, and we can have a bigger impact that way. The city also did studies on what was causing crashes, so what behaviors were leading to crashes, and the city found that speeding was the number one factor. Not yielding to pedestrians was a huge factor. Running red lights, running stop signs. So with all of this data, it's, again, it's power, because you can address those specific issues, and that's different than approaches that were done in the past.
And so then how did that data then turn into solutions?
Well, that map that I mentioned to you, it's called the High Injury Network. The city was then able to, when they were coming up with plans for where to do street redesign projects, they used that map to focus their efforts. And they actually picked high injury intersections. And within the first year or two, put really quick and cheap improvements and effective improvements in those intersections. So they put improvements in hundreds of high injury intersections within the first 2 years of Vision Zero.
And can you say a little bit about what those technologies, those low-tech technologies look like?
Yeah, it's really a lot of paint and maybe some traffic signal changes, but it's literally could be as simple as striping a crosswalk. So some streets don't have a crosswalk that's striped. And so just by striping a crosswalk in a certain way, you can reduce crashes by 50%. So the city did simple things like that. They also, I don't know if you've seen on Market Street here in the city, but they've basically, as a quick way to increase the safety, they've painted out sort of sidewalk extensions in this khaki color paint and then put up posts. And so basically what that does is it narrows the intersection, and that slows turning vehicles, and it also increases yielding. The city actually put a lot of these in, and they did a study, and that's exactly what they found, these results, these safety results. So also things with traffic signals, giving pedestrians a head start before the vehicles get to go at some intersections, the pedestrians actually get to start first so that they get out a little bit further in the intersection and they're more visible. So things like that, the city did all over, especially in the high injury areas. And so was really a quick and swift reaction.
So then, of course, the next question, of course, is,
I knew you were coming to this.
is what results have we seen?
That is a good question, and that's something we're still figuring out. The tough thing with a 10-year goal like Vision Zero is you don't often see the changes from year to year, right? Statistically, you need multiple years to see really the story that's happening. At the same time, we haven't seen really much movement in traffic fatalities in the city. So 2014, it was 31. 2015, it was 31. And last year, it was 30. That's really not movement. But if you look at the number of people walking and biking and driving in the city, that has increased in the past few years. And so luckily, we haven't seen an increase in the crashes with an increase in that traffic. So that's definitely something that the city should take credit for. And in the rest of the country, there was a report that was recently put out, crashes have been increasing in the whole rest of the country. So we're bucking that trend here. So we are doing something right. We're just not doing enough of it, and we're not doing it quickly enough.
So that is the issue, is how quickly are the changes coming. So Roger Rudick, I wanted to turn to you next. You're the editor of Streets Blog San Francisco, and you, even though the name is San Francisco, you take a really global perspective in the writing that you do. So tell us how San Francisco compares. You know, why? Well, first of all, why is it the worst county in the state? And then how does it compare to other cities, other parts of the world?
I'm not sure it's the worst county in the state. Does that mesh with?
I'm not sure either.
Yeah. I think Los Angeles has a higher rate of pedestrian fatalities. Okay. I'm not sure. I was going through the data a little bit before. But my perspective is this. We know how to solve a lot of these problems. Certainly painting bulb outs that Kathy was talking about, steps like that are great. But if you go overseas, and that's kind of where Vision Zero originated, I have a bit of experience in the Netherlands, and I actually worked with a traffic engineer here and did a tour of some of the infrastructure that we've built in San Francisco. And I think there's a tendency here to want to reinvent the wheel. If you go to some of these countries where it's almost unheard of for someone to get killed by a car, and crashes are so rare that they actually are front page news when they happen. And you look, there's certain things that they do, and I'll give a specific example. In most of the countries in Europe where you have a better record, you'll find that a traffic signal is placed on the near side of an intersection, right? So here, there's, you know, we have kind of standards, right? So we always put the traffic signal on the far side of the intersection. Now, that might sound like a simple thing, but what tends to happen is then people creep forward, or they stop in front of the crosswalk, right? So you'll have a higher rate of people getting run over. If you put the signal on the near side and you position it just right so that a motorist can't actually go across a crosswalk or edge into the intersection without losing sight of that signal, well, guess what? They don't do it. They stay farther back, and you end up with fewer crashes at the intersection, which is where most crashes take place. So that's why I try and take a global perspective in Streets Blog, so that, you know, I want to kind of inform the public that the way that we've been doing things all our lives might not be the best way to do it.
And so that's just a very simple potential fix, although I didn't hear it in your list of things that have been tried. So Kathy, how do we reconcile sort of what's been out there and tested elsewhere with what's been chosen here in San Francisco? Not that you're answering for it, but you may have some sense of how things got prioritized.
Yeah, I do. What got prioritized was what they could do as quickly as possible and cheaply as possible. And so that's what was prioritized initially, and that's what I was talking about initially. Mm. And unfortunately, in the city, moving a traffic signal from one side to the other
big enterprise.
Cost probably $100,000, let's just say.
So not that easy. Okay.
It's a simple fix, right? Mm-hmm. It's not hard to understand but just the person power and the money to implement it. And so that's what we're kind of coming across is we have major corridors that we know are dangerous all along the corridor, Market Street, Taraval, 19th. We have Geary. We have so many of these. But to transform that entire corridor in a robust, comprehensive way takes a lot of time and a lot of money. We don't have the time. We have the money. We don't have the time to wait, though, because people are getting hit every day in this city. You know, we mentioned that 3 pedestrians are hit every day. Actually, 10 people are in crashes every day in the city. It's not just pedestrians. We have bicyclists, motorcyclists really suffer, and car drivers and passengers. So, you know, it might be expensive and it might take time, but we don't have that time. So we need to get moving.
So, Roger, any other fixes that you've seen elsewhere, have learned about elsewhere that we could consider adopting here?
Yeah. A good example is the protected intersection. We actually have one in San Francisco now. It's Division and
Ninth.
And Ninth, right? So, and actually, I think for your listeners, if someone is driving through that area or walking through that area or biking through that area, take a look at it. That is an approximation of a very standard intersection design that they use overseas. It's really novel here. But what they do is they make it so cars have to slow down quite a bit before they make their turns. And what they do is they sort of extend kind of a what they call a refuge island into the intersection. The protection for cyclists continues all the way through the intersection. This is something that we almost never do. I assume your listeners have noticed this. They probably haven't thought about it before, but a bike lane just ends when you get to the intersection. So the point where a cyclist, for example, is in the most danger, there's no protection and no markings whatsoever. So, you know, that intersection that I'm referring to cost a lot of money to do, and it took a lot of time. But I think what we need to be doing is kind of doing the quick fixes and then looking at these long-term goals, which are better solutions, but they're going to take more time. Now, that said, I do wish that the city would look at some things that really aren't that expensive that they've been doing in places like Portland and Vancouver, British Columbia, for example, where what they'll do is they'll get, you know, something as simple as a big concrete planter. They did this a lot in New York, too. If your listeners have been to Times Square, they'll see all these big planters, which look really nice, but they're actually there to keep cars from incurring onto pedestrian areas. So, you know, you can kind of set up a makeshift protected intersection just using simple things like planters and concrete blocks. Now, what's going to happen is cars are occasionally going to glance off of these blocks and get dented and scratched up, and a lot of motorists are not going to like that. But you got to say, is it better that a car glances off of a concrete block or a planter or a human? And I'm going to go with the planter is the better thing.
And Kathy, that does raise the question for me. What kind of pushback have you or others heard about these types of changes? How are motorists who, of course, at some point in their day are pedestrians as well, but but when they're motorists. How do they feel about these changes?
I think it depends when you talk to them. I think if you talk to them when they're pedestrians, their perspective changes. I think we all have different perspectives based on how we get around. And I think we all, honestly, we all behave badly and make mistakes all the different ways we get around. I hear a lot from people who are upset about pedestrians not behaving well. And so I can understand why motorists would be upset. They're used to having a lot of space on the street. And, you know, but years ago, they didn't have a lot of space on the street. That changed. We used to have transit taking up most of the space on our street, and we used to have really wide sidewalks. And so when that change happened, you know, the people were upset about it that were walking. And, you know, that was before, but then our streets were designed really to move traffic in our city. We have, you know, huge sort of one-way couplets through our city, through the Tenderloin, through SoMa, that just really bisected neighborhoods. And so that's
Panhandle.
Exactly.
Western Addition.
Yeah, so that's what we're used to. So when someone changes what you're used to and what you expect, it's very upsetting. I understand that. But it comes back to that's not more important than someone's life. And that's really what we're facing here in the city.
So far in the first 15 or so minutes of the program, we've been talking about efforts to re-engineer the streets or reverse engineer them, perhaps. What other aspects does Vision Zero include?
Vision Zero has several other aspects, but I do want to stress that Walk SF believes that re-engineering the streets is the most important thing that we can do, because humans are going to make mistakes. So we need to design a transportation system that anticipates those mistakes and makes sure that they don't result in severe injury or death. Because why not have a transportation system that encourages safe behavior? You know, we can enforce. The city does do Vision Zero enforcement. But, you know, we always have police cutbacks. And so that's not something we can count on. We also have instances of sort of racial bias from our police force. So then we're introducing other harm sometimes if we're using enforcement for Vision Zero. Education is another thing that the city does for Vision Zero. But you know what? You would have to have billions of dollars upon billions to reach everyone who comes here in the city. And then even if you did, to change their behavior is something altogether different. You know, you can educate people. People know that speeding's bad. People know how to behave well. But we're humans. We don't quite do what we know what is best. So if we engineer that street so that you can't drive safely, or can't drive safely, that would be terrible.
That's where we are
now.
Sorry. Okay.
That's the current condition.
If you could engineer that street so you can't drive fast, you have to drive slowly, immediately lives are saved. So, because we know that as speed decreases, your chances of survival increase. So having a baseline safe transportation system, to me, is the smartest thing we can do.
Let me reintroduce the program. If you're just joining us, this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing safety of our streets with our guests here in the studio, Kathy DeLuca, Interim Director of Walk SF, Roger Rudick, Editor of Streets Blog San Francisco, and in a moment we'll turn to Julie Mitchell, co-founder of San Francisco Bay Area's Families for Safe Streets. We invite you to call in with your questions and comments. The number to dial to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KLW website, or tweet us at cityvisionsKLW, and we got a Facebook page too. So Julie Mitchell, I did want to turn to you next.
Okay.
You work with families and you're trying to bring awareness to this issue, particularly because you have a very personal reason for doing this work. Traffic fatality affected your family. Tell us about the work you've done and what this means to you.
Well, after my son's death, I knew I needed to do something to turn our tragedy into something positive to prevent other families from experiencing the same devastation that we've experienced. So the first thing was, after seeing how dangerous the streets were for bicyclists, I decided it needed to involve making the streets safer. So I contacted the SFMTA and asked them how I could get involved in making changes for protected bike lanes. I started out doing some advocacy work for the SFMTA, although I never felt like it was enough. So I knew I needed to do something more in my son's memory. And SFMTA told me about a group of families in New York that were making positive changes in the laws in New York. And the founder there had lost her son to traffic violence as well. After speaking to the New York founder, I knew this was what I needed to do. And Walk SF were more than happy to help me get it started. I planned for the first meeting in April of 2016, and we've been having monthly meetings ever since. And last November, we had our official launch on November 20th at the World Day of Remembrance for Road Traffic Victims, which is a national day of remembering victims of traffic violence and is held every year on the third Sunday in November. We had planned World Day of Remembrance around our launch of Families for Safe Streets and had a memorial walk and press conference in front of City Hall. And City Hall was lit up in yellow to symbolize our group. Mm-hmm. So since then, we've been made our primary focus on getting ASC passed, which is automated speed enforcement.
Say more about that.
Well, ASC is an effective tool that has been proven to decrease traffic fatalities. It's in 141 other communities in the United States, and it's life-saving technology that it's unfair that we don't have. Unsafe speed is the number one factor in serious injury and fatal traffic collisions in San Francisco. And so since April, we started doing a lot of lobbying in Sacramento, trying to get this bill passed. We weren't able to get it passed this year, so it's turned into a two-year bill, and we're going to continue to fight for it this coming year.
Great. Did you want to add something there?
Yeah, I mean, just so our listeners, I guess, yeah, to make it a little clear what automatic speed enforcement entails. Basically, you'd have a camera mounted above certain intersections or in certain places. It's not technically radar, but we can think of it as radar, would spot someone who is, I think it's 10 miles an hour over the speed limit, Kathy?
It'll be at least 10, yeah.
About 10 miles over the speed limit. If the person's speeding, it'll take a picture of the license plate, maybe capture the face.
No, not the face. Okay. Definitely not.
Okay, capture the license plate, and you'd get fined. It wouldn't be points on the license because it's this was sort of the way the legislation has been sculpted, mm-hmm, because of the concern that someone else might be driving your car. My perspective is, well, then don't loan it to someone that you don't trust to drive your car. We get parking tickets when people borrow our cars sometimes. But anyway, that's
but a parking
me
ticket,
editorializing.
Parking tickets, you don't get a point on your license either.
Yes.
So there you go. It's the same thing as it's the same penalties as a parking ticket.
Yeah, yeah. I
anyway, go on,
yeah,
Roger.
Fine, but fair enough. But what it is it's a way to basically get eyes on the street to make sure that people aren't speeding.
Yeah.
And you can stand on pretty much any intersection, any street in San Francisco, and you'll see pretty much everybody going 10 miles an hour above the speed limit. You'll see people going 20 and 30 miles an hour above the speed limit. It's going to be a long time till we're able to engineer streets in ways that will kind of force people to go the speed limit. Until we've done that, this is a pretty good deterrent. And I've actually lived in Europe, and I've seen how this works. It's pretty darn impressive when you're on a road in Europe and you're driving along and everybody is going the speed limit. It's magical. But they know they're going to get, you know, a $300 fine or whatever it is. If they go above the speed limit, it's just going to happen automatically.
And let me jump in on that, because actually here our fines will not be $300. They're going to actually be really low. The fine is probably, as the legislation stands now, maybe $50, $100. Yeah. So $100, I think, is the base. And then you can get that down to $20 at this point if you're low income. So it's not a revenue generation. I think a lot of people get concerned, like, the police are just trying to get money out of us. This is all about deterrence. These cameras have been proven to deter speeding. So the cameras, once someone has gotten one of these tickets in other municipalities in the country, they're very unlikely to get a second.
And what's been the opposition to this? Why hasn't this happened already?
That's a really good question. So some cities in California had the cameras, had speed cameras years ago, San Jose being one of them. And I don't have all of the information, but I know that there was just some question about, are the cameras calibrated right? Are they accurate? Are you capturing private information? There are lots of concerns about cameras. And so it was made not legal at our state level, but that was many years ago. And, you know, in San Francisco, we have red light cameras. We have cameras on the Bay Bridge or on the Golden Gate Bridge that capture your license plate if you don't have a fast track. And so this is much more a part of our culture now. And so we think the time is right. We know this tool works. We know that speed is really hurting people on our streets. So we're really going to push, and we're excited about this great technology.
So that's an example of enforcement.
It is enforcement.
As opposed to engineering.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, and I wanted to point out, Kathy pointed out before, the fears of profiling. Mm. This is a way to get around that. I mean, cameras and automatic speed enforcement are not going to profile. They're just going to look at which cars are exceeding the speed limit.
All right. We've got several calls to get to, so let's go to those now. Let's start with David. David, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My opinion is that the emphasis on speed as a factor in traffic safety and accidents is drastically overstated. I think that the much more important factors in traffic safety are not speed, but lack of driver training, lack of driver education, driver inattention, and poor driving habits. And I think the single most important thing that can be done to increase traffic safety, including other vehicles, including bicycles and pedestrians, is to increase with great vigor the enforcement of the laws against driving with your hands on your cell phone or your device. Not a week goes by that I fail to take evasive action to avoid an accident with someone who is not paying attention to their driving. They're paying attention to their device. Anytime you pull up to an intersection at a red light or a stop sign and you cannot see a driver's hands on the steering wheel and they're looking down, you know that they are violating the law. And if there were more vigorous enforcement in this law, then countless lives will be saved and you wouldn't have to rely on enforcing an artificially low speed limit. Thank you.
Thanks for your call, David. So, Roger, you wanted to respond to that.
Yeah, I wanted to address that. You know, David makes a perfectly valid point about distracted driving. I totally agree with that. In fact, if I when I was coming to the station and I went through a crosswalk, if I hadn't been paying attention and stopped, there was a motorist who blew right through the crosswalk, and sure enough, he was looking down at his phone or whatever it was. But where I have to take exception is, and this is where data comes in, and this is something that's been very important to this fight, that we've gotten a lot more data to show what the reality is. When David says that speed is not a factor, he's just wrong. I mean, there's enough data now that we know that is not the case.
I don't think he said it wasn't a factor. I think he said it wasn't the most important factor.
It is.
I'm just trying to represent what he said.
Fair enough. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, when the data is compiled, we find if a car is going 20 miles per hour, and I'm looking at the stats in front of me right now, a pedestrian who's struck by a car has about a 90% chance of surviving. Bring it up to 40 miles per hour, 90% chance of dying. You know, there's human reaction time. And the other thing that I personally find very frustrating about speeding in San Francisco is, you know, our lights are timed to the speed limit, right? So people just speed between intersections to the next light. So we have people getting killed and seriously injured, and there's no advantage to it. I mean, the person's not even getting anywhere faster. I would like to see automatic speed enforcement to make sure that people actually go the speed limit, because, you know, when you speed, you're wasting gas, you're endangering people, and you're not getting anywhere any faster. So, you know, I take exception to that part of it.
All right. Let me go ahead and reintroduce the program. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pace, and tonight we're joined by three guests who are talking about the Vision Zero plan to eliminate traffic fatalities that involve pedestrians and cyclists by 2024, excuse me. Here in the studio with me are Kathy DeLuca, Interim Director of Walk SF. We were just hearing there from Roger Rudick, who's editor of Streets Blog San Francisco. And a few minutes ago, we heard from Julie Mitchell, co-founder of San Francisco Bay Area Families for Safe Streets. The number to dial to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KLW website, tweet us, or put a post up on Facebook. So let's go next to Richard from San Francisco. Richard, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Yes, hi.
Yes, I'm surprised Tom McGuire isn't on the program, or nobody from SFMTA. To me, the biggest problem in getting down to Vision Zero is that SFMTA needs to be reformed and meet more of the needs of the city. It needs to be organized like the planning department, and people need to get out of the office. And I'm surprised that nobody's talked about it. You know, there's been deaths on Fulton Street, but they haven't fixed it. They seem to be like fire department. When the mayor sees an accident, you know, unfortunate, boom, like Golden Gate Park is being fixed right away. But Fulton Street, where somebody died and injured, it's been a couple of years and they haven't done anything. And data isn't always the old thing. Fulton Street's a real fast street, but like my neighbor says, people know not to cross it. I almost got hit by a car going on, you know, trying to cross at a crosswalk on Fulton. So I don't think data is the complete answer. I think SFMTA needs to be divided by teams, and they need to talk to the people on the ground to see what is, because data is not always the true answer, and they need to listen to the people. I think the people know what safety concerns they want in their neighborhood, and SFMTA staff is very hard to get them to listen to neighborhood concerns.
Thanks so much, Richard, for your call. And for the record, we did reach out to the MTA to be join us on this program this evening, and they did not respond. So I want to introduce someone who we talked about at the top of the hour, and that's excuse me here. I'm just suddenly losing my papers here. We have a guest who's joining us by phone, Dr. Rochelle Dicker, and she's a former director of the Injury Prevention Center at UCSF. You're calling us from Los Angeles. You're a trauma surgeon. Tell us about your experience with working with victims of traffic accidents.
Hi, thanks for having me on the program. And I am down in Los Angeles. That also has a very unique and disturbing pedestrian injury issue. And I just transferred over last month from, I was a trauma surgeon at San Francisco General, now Zuckerberg San Francisco General, for over a decade, and saw my share of families in complete distress, and really horrific situations right out from our city. Two things are striking. One is there's nothing more profound than going out to give a family bad news that was completely unexpected, meaning these are sudden events in people's lives and they're transformative. And the more I get into this type of work, the worse that impact has on all of us. And it's that kind of an impact. It's seeing the families, and the gentleman before, the caller, Richard, I believe, said it right. I'm a social scientist, and I believe in the data a lot, but the families matter. And hearing these stories is powerful, and it makes me as a trauma surgeon join that effort of Vision Zero, so that we really don't need people like me, and rather turn a surgeon into an advocate.
So tell us, besides the work that you do trying to save lives and then comforting families as best you can, how do you see your work contributing to the impact that we're trying to, that the advocates around the table are trying to make happen here?
So I think it's really important that we're active members in Vision Zero from the Trauma Center, and Megan Weir from the Department of Public Health and Leilani Schwartz, I worked with closely and continue to, and now my colleagues at the Trauma Center, including Dr. Katrine Julliard, is working very closely to gather the most detailed and refined amount of information that we can. Traditionally, most of the data has come from police records, and it's incredibly important to have that information, but it only tells a piece of the story, and we demonstrated that years ago, that in fact the trauma registry data gathers a whole other set, and if you look at a Venn diagram of it, the police don't have certain records and we don't have certain records. Combining it is really powerful because then you get the complete story. So I have been working with the Department of Public Health and now MTA because of Vision Zero, which has brought us all together in the real belief that this is a public health problem. What are the risk factors? What are protective factors? And if we look at trauma registry data and I can help to set up this comprehensive surveillance system, then we can really make some informed decisions as to where to target the streets, as your guests have been talking about for most of the hour.
Great. And are you going to get to continue this work in Los Angeles?
Yes, absolutely. I have to kind of get my shop set up down here, but that is the plan. Los Angeles, as you mentioned, has some major issues as well, and they have a Vision Zero plan. So I'm just starting to get myself involved there. But still, even today, working on some cost analysis from San Francisco, because I'll continue some of that work.
Kathy, you wanted to respond there.
Yeah, I don't know, Dr. Dicker, if you mentioned this, but here in San Francisco, we know that 50% of the patients at our trauma center at Zuckerberg General are there for transportation-related injuries, 50%. So it is, like Dr. Dicker did say, a public health epidemic. And so having folks like Rochelle and our Department of Public Health partners like Megan Weir share this sort of information, share their stories. Honestly, as an advocate, I find it lends validity, a lot of validity to our fight. So thank you, Dr. Dicker, for all your work.
Well, San Francisco is an amazing collaborative city, and I was lucky to be a part of it for so long. So thank you, Kathy.
So we have several callers to get to in a moment, but I want to get to an email from Pierre. He says, one thing I haven't heard mentioned is the change in driving and traffic habits and patterns in San Francisco in the past several years. Drivers are far more aggressive and impatient because of clogged city streets. Between the number of ride shares stopping randomly on the street, delivery vehicles stopping and delivering the exponentially greater number of packages, and the tech buses, people's nerves are frayed. Most still adhere to the law, but many are driving recklessly because they are impatient. Please have more traffic cops out to get offenders, putting others in danger. Driving has gotten much, much worse in the city in the recent past because of the boom. Now, Kathy, you had said earlier that the increase in people walking and bicycling hasn't necessarily shown an uptick in accidents. But what do you make of Pierre's comments? Do we have any data to back up his impressions?
I am not sure how much data we do have. But I do tell you that I hear, well, Roger knows. Let's have Roger jump in.
Yeah, I know there's kind of an ongoing fight between city government and Lyft and Uber to get the amount of, you know, to get all the data from them. It's fairly proprietary, and there's always a lot of back and forth. I know there was a
data
study
about...
Oh, sorry, data about ride shares. This is part of what the caller was talking about and kind of the impact that they've had on urban traffic. Mm. I know they did a study in New York City a few years ago that one of the sister publications, Streets Block San Francisco, covered that showed that indeed Uber and Lyft were making traffic worse in Manhattan. I think there's been some research to show similar results here. I can tell you on the ground, I've covered a lot of protests on Valencia Street, which is kind of ground zero with the whole Uber, Lyft, tech bus, and cyclists vying for street space. And it is, yeah, it's a disaster. And I don't understand. That's one area where I don't understand why MTA can't do something about it a little more quickly. You know, I was
And what would be a solution there?
Well, that one is fairly obvious. Parking protected bike lanes. And what that is, the way they set the street up right now, you've got a stripe alongside the parking lane. And this is kind of, you know, when you stop and think about it, this is sort of the way most American streets are set up. But you've got cyclists, fragile human beings riding between parked cars that can throw their doors open on the right side. On the left side, you've got moving cars and trucks moving by at high speed. So this is just a formula for disaster, and we've seen it over and over again. There's been a lot of people injured on Valencia. The solution is pretty simple. You move the parking lane, one lane over to the left. You put the bike lane between the parked cars and the curb. Hopefully you have a physical separation as well, be them posts or I know in Alameda they did something like this where they took recycled tires and sort of pressed them into the asphalt to make sure that the cars don't intrude onto that bike lane. And now you've got a wall of cars, parked cars, protecting the bicycles and the pedestrians to an extent because it shortens the distance that they have to cross at intersections, and it ends up with a safer situation. This is how streets in the Netherlands and a lot of northern European countries are treated to keep cyclists and pedestrians safe from speeding traffic. It also does what we were talking about before. It narrows things down a little bit, forces cars to go a little more slowly, a little more cautiously.
Okay. Let's go next to Karen. Karen, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Yes. Now, I was taught to look both ways before I cross the street, but nobody is doing that. Everybody is on the phone. That is what the epidemic is. They're on the phone texting. They're on the phone on the Facebook. They're on the phone while they're pushing their baby strollers. They're on the phone while they're bicycling. I see kids on a bicycle, no hands on the handlebars, and they're talking on the phone. So that means to me that nobody's paying attention. And that is what is part of this epidemic, is the lack of attention. And that's causing people to step out into a crosswalk even. They're on the phone. They never look both ways. These are students. I'm in North Berkeley near the university. I'll see four or five kids. Each one of them is on the phone. They never look both ways. So then you get a driver that's texting or on a device and out of control speeding, and you've got like a massive collision. So it's the pedestrians that also need to step up and take responsibility for paying attention, because nobody's paying attention. That's how it looks to me. I don't have a smartphone. I don't talk on the phone while I'm driving. I got both hands on the wheel, and I definitely stop at every corner and look both ways. So there's responsibility all the way around. That's my comment.
Thank you so much, Karen. So Julie, I want to bring this question to you then. How do you respond to a comment like Karen's when we're trying to point fingers here and the finger gets pointed at the pedestrian?
Well, you're driving a vehicle that has the potential to kill someone. A bicycle and a pedestrian are very vulnerable and are not going to kill somebody. So I think that the person driving the vehicle has the has the responsibility to watch out for the bicyclists and pedestrians. I'm not saying that that every bike and pedestrian is doing the right thing, but being a driver, it's your responsibility to watch out for them.
And Kathy and Roger, I know you perked up quite a bit there when you heard Karen's comments. Wanted to hear from you as well.
Yeah, so I was glad to hear that Karen said she's a really safe driver. And I do agree with Karen that we all do need to take responsibility. We should all be aware of our surroundings and be responsible road users in every way. And at the same time, I agree with Julie. And the data shows that the majority of severe injury crashes and fatal crashes are due to driver behavior, not due to pedestrian behavior, not due to bicyclist behavior.
Roger?
Yeah, that's what I wanted to
say. Ditto. Ditto.
Ditto.
Okay. Let's go next to Kevin. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Cars hit people. People don't hit cars. Cars are the big machines, you know, two-ton machines. And one of the things that speaks to the intractability of the city to make changes. We've had a law in the books since the 30s, CVC 22107, that empowers pedestrians to know what's going on in the environment, and that is the requirement to signal turns, yet police don't enforce it. I had a little chuckle in public at a Chief Sir when I suggested that his officers in routine patrolling, not emergency work, use their turn signals and to start educating the public and telling people to do it and then enforcing it. Pedestrian safety for me, I've worked in it for 10 years, is to look at the street from the point of view of the pedestrian. Can they see everything? And one of the most important things to know is which way are the moving machines going. That's what turn signals do, and it even helps other drivers. Now, it's curious to me that they wouldn't take this free thing that's already law. You don't need any policy study, yet they're very reluctant to make any changes. And the city and the mayor's office have studied pedestrian safety many, many, many times, and still very little comes out of it. And I want to echo the earlier caller, Richard's, comments about the MTA, because it also dovetails with the other comments I heard about the street design in the Netherlands. The answer to engineering is right there. You can look on YouTube, search for Dutch street design. And the answer for how to design an intersection, including built bike lanes, is there. Yet they won't do it. They study, 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 and they spend their six-figure salaries designing apps for iPhones instead of doing the engineering needed for the city. So those are my two comments. The first one, turn signaling, it's free, it costs nothing. The second one, the answers are there, but there's gargantuan city agency won't move its big fat duff. It needs reformation, as that caller said. Thank you.
Thanks for your comment. Let's go next to Steve. Steve, welcome to the program.
Hi. I'm Steve from San Francisco. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can. Go ahead.
Okay, great. So I've been actually making more of an effort to be a better pedestrian because I am so upset. And I am judgmental, and I point a lot of fingers, so I figure I better get it together and be a better pedestrian. But I have to say, in my humble opinion, the most irresponsible types of people on the road are the bicyclists. They go everywhere and everything they can. I'm more concerned about getting hit by a bicycle than I am about getting hit by a car. Why doesn't the city be honest and take responsibility for the fact that the Bicycle Coalition has got the city by the short hairs? And basically, they've been kissing the butt of the Bicycle Coalition for years now. I talk to many people about this. Bicyclists go anywhere and everywhere. They cut in and out. They don't give a damn. They figure, you know, if you're in the way, it's your problem. And it's just terrible. I'm not saying that I'm sure there are responsible bicyclists, just as there are responsible pedestrians and responsible motorists. But bicyclists, by far, in my opinion, as a pedestrian, are the least responsible people on the street. And it's not going to do any good if the city has a blind spot as far as dealing with that. I mean, there should be some more regulations. Every time something like that comes up, the city backs away.
All right.
I'm really glad that they never did anything like that stupid Idaho stop garbage. That would have really been bad for pedestrians. Anyway, I don't know what they have to say about this, but I don't think the city is being, or representatives of the city, are being honest in how they're dealing with the Bicycle Coalition. They get away with murder.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for your call. So Kathy and then Roger.
Yeah, so as a pedestrian advocacy organization, we hear from a lot of people walking about concerns about bicyclists, and especially seniors and people with disabilities. And so, you know, if a senior or a person with a disability is hit or even brushed by someone on a bicycle, they have real concerns about their health. But I'm going to go back to what I said at the top of the hour, which is we can design safe streets for all of our users. And if we had safe places for people to bicycle, we wouldn't need bicycles and pedestrians on the sidewalk together. People bike on the sidewalk because they don't feel comfortable biking anywhere else. So again, our system is failing us. We're not failing each other as people. We are people. We have human foibles and great things about us. But this is a system failure of not understanding who you're designing for and how to keep everyone safe. We can do it. We know how to do it. And I'm confident we will do it.
Can you say what the data shows about how many pedestrian-involved incidents involve cyclists?
Practically none for severe injuries, none for fatalities. It's really motorist pedestrian that causes the most severe and fatal injuries.
Roger?
Look, there are jerky motorists. There are jerky cyclists. But
and jerky pedestrians.
There are jerky pedestrians.
Thanks a
lot. There are just jerky, jerky people. But, you know, if a cyclist is behaving irresponsibly, well, the cyclist might be top speed 17 miles an hour, might be a heavy guy who weighs 200 pounds. Figure out the momentum versus a car going 40 miles an hour that weighs 2 tons. You know, I personally don't understand why people have this visceral response, because, you know, they saw a cyclist do something really obnoxious, you know, 2 years ago or 5 minutes ago, and suddenly cyclists are irresponsible. I see people, you know, from all those categories doing irresponsible things. To me, the solution, again, is, you know, we look at the data. It's the automobiles that are causing the death and destruction. You know, in other countries, they do something which, you know, obviously, if it's about race, segregation is terrible. If we're talking about bicycles and pedestrians and cars, I actually think it's a pretty good idea. And that's why I'm a big believer in protected bike lanes and protected intersections. You know, I drive a car, too. And if you're stuck behind a cyclist, I understand it can be annoying. I don't feel that impulse to honk at them that some people do. But if we redesign our streets where everybody knows where they're supposed to be, and we know how to do this from looking at models from other countries, we can eliminate this kind of inherent conflict. But again, I don't understand the visceral response that the caller exhibited.
I do. Again, I think it goes back to speed. So bikes go very fast. And if you're a vulnerable person, if you are a senior that's kind of frail and has a hard time walking, someone whizzing by you is very scary. So I do understand the visceral reaction. But I feel like we have a solution to that. It doesn't have to be that way. And so
But why for a speeding cyclist? I mean, I will hear people complaining about speeding cyclists more than a speeding car.
Yeah, I know.
That doesn't make any sense.
I understand. Yeah.
Let's go next to Ron from Glen Park. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I just wanted to know about self-driving cars. Mm-hmm. Do you think that when the technology comes about that pedestrians and bicyclists are going to be safer on roads with automated vehicles? I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Ron. Anyone know an answer to that? Go ahead, Roger.
Maybe a little bit. I don't think it's the panacea that it's being presented as. You know, there's a real danger with self-driving cars. The United States of America, we tend to get a little obsessed with technological solutions. You know, sometimes we put aside very obvious solutions. I keep going back to some of the street designs they've used in Europe. You know, we don't know where self-driving cars are going to lead. Hopefully they'll be safer than human driving cars. But so far they're not ready. So, you know, we have to anticipate where they're going to go, but I don't think it's going to solve all of our problems. And if we start building cities like we did in the 50s and 60s and building giant freeways through our downtowns, if we put the Embarcadero freeway back because we're going to now have driverless cars solving all our problems, I think we're going to be very unhappy with what our city is going to look like in the future.
Hmm. And so maybe this is not necessarily the fairest thing to ask, but if the MTA were here at our table tonight, what would be the one thing you would implore them to do in the next phase of this project?
I've actually, WalkSF and the Vision Zero Coalition, which is a group of community organizations that are basically advocating for Vision Zero, 40-plus organizations, we've actually been pushing the city to develop a long-term strategic plan. 10 years isn't that long term, but they actually don't have a plan of how they're going to achieve the goal by 2024. They have a goal of 2-year plan and then another 2-year plan. The plans aren't connected, and there's no actual roadmap for how to get there. So I don't think, unless we ask the big questions and actually have that big vision of how we're going to get there, that's what I think we need to do.
Roger?
One of the things I've implored the MTA to do in some of the writing I've done for Streets Blog is to get kind of squads together that can go fix things quickly. And when I say, you know, Kathy talked about the paint and the safe hit posts that they'll put down sometimes. Even that seems like it's kind of a heavy lift for them sometimes. But I'd like them just to find some planters and some Jersey barrier / K-rail and put it in a big warehouse and just say, okay, we're going to fix Valencia tomorrow and just do it. That can be done. We've seen it done in New York City fairly quickly. Someone mentioned Tom McGuire, who actually worked in New York City, and he was there when a lot of it was done. You know, you see places like I did a report in Vancouver, British Columbia once, where they got some oblong concrete planters and they just put them in overnight. We need to stop all the hand-wringing. We need to stop trying to make everybody in the city happy and say, this is what the data tells us. This is where people are getting hurt. We got to stop people from getting hurt. End of story.
And Julie, I wanted to end with you. What message would you have either for the MTA or anyone else listening out there for what you would hope would happen in the next several years here?
I would hope that they would put in true protected bike lanes so bicyclists could be safe and wouldn't need to feel like they needed to ride on the sidewalk or impede on pedestrians. I like to see them have tougher penalties for people that have caused a fatality. And I would like to see ASC passed and supported.
And again, that's the
automated speed enforcement.
Automated speed enforcement, which is right now stuck in somewhere in the
yes.
legislative works in Sacramento.
Exactly.
Okay. Perhaps we'll invite you back in another few years to give us the report out of how things are going. In the meantime, I want to thank all of you for joining me. We were joined this evening by Kathy DeLuca, Interim Director of WalkSF, Julie Mitchell, co-founder of San Francisco Bay Area Families for Safe Streets, Roger Rudick, editor of Streets Blog San Francisco, and by phone, Dr. Rochelle Dicker, former director of the Injury Prevention Center at UCSF. Thanks for joining me this evening.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thanks.
Thank you.
For a link to this and other City Visions shows to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at klw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe, and tonight's show was produced by Judith Sansone. Join me next Monday for another edition of City Visions. We'll be doing an encore presentation, so tune in then. Thanks for listening. Good night, and have a great week.